For most of us, the idea of homelessness is just that, an idea. We've got jobs, paychecks, but a lot of us have also got our share of personal debt and very little savings. So how fine a line is it, really, between us and homelessness? Angela Angel can answer that question. After failing to pay a few utility bills, she got a knock on the door from a social worker.
She gave me a week to get my power turned back on. And she said, when I come back in a week, if your utilities are not turned back on, I'm going to take your children.
7 days later, Angela was given a painful choice. Lose your children to state custody or move into a homeless shelter. Angela opted for the shelter. But she ended up getting past all the obstacles life threw at her. She's now not only a homeowner, she's also the director over the very same shelter where she once stayed. I'm Aaron Henkin, sitting in for Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is produced by North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. It's co-produced and distributed by American Public Media.
On any given night, an estimated 800,000 people are homeless. At one point in her life, Angela Angel found herself about to become one of them. She was living in a trailer home in Opelousas, Louisiana, with her 7 children, and she was pregnant with twins. The trailer was Section 8 housing. She was on welfare, feeding her family with food stamps. After failing to pay a few utility bills, her power was shut off.
We went 4 months with no electricity, so we would use candles at night. I still was able to cook because I had gas and water, so I would boil gumbo pots of water. I'd actually boil about 5 pots of water so that me and the children could take baths every night. We would tell stories to keep them quiet before bedtime. This is the one that I remember about a lady living in an abandoned home that actually had no electricity. She had to work in the fields to bring in food. She had to haul water, basically kind of what I was doing, but in a different way to kind of make it interesting so they would pay attention and listen up to reality that sometimes things happen and you can overcome those obstacles as long as you just keep trying and trying. But every afternoon they'd come back from school. I'd help with the homework while we could still see. Once they ate dinner, I had the water already boiled and I'd put it in a tub so they could take baths. And I sent the kids to school, even though we had no electricity, clean and neat, always properly dressed. And nobody realized that we were living like that, not even my landlord that would pass every afternoon. Because when she would pass, I'd have the candles on in the front room. When the kids went to take a bath, we had the candles there. So we just kind of moved the candles around throughout the house wherever was needed.
Angela's electricity was turned off, but her trailer still had gas so she could cook meals for her 7 children. But shopping for food was tough.
There was a grocery store about 6 blocks from where I lived, so I'd walk every day and made sure I had fresh meat because I couldn't store it in my refrigerator because there was no electricity. My lights got turned off because I was receiving welfare. It seemed to be enough to make ends meet, because I was living with one of my children's father who was working, and then when he got hurt offshore, that's when everything just kind of basically fell apart and he wasn't getting any workman comp. That's why we were really without electricity.
I wonder how long you were prepared to go on living like this.
I would have went on for as long as it took until we financially got back able to put the lights back on. We were just being hopeful and praying every day and hoping that some kind of way things would happen so that we could get the lights on and we wouldn't have to lose the trailer. One thing about Section 8 is if somebody finds out in that department that you're without any one of your utilities, then you lose that voucher. So I was really afraid of that.
So it sounds like things were obviously really tough, but you had figured out a system to manage. You'd gone on for about 4 months doing this, and then one day the Office of Children's Services was called on you.
Correct. She just knocked on the door and she said, I'm with OCS and I'm here to investigate that you've been living here for several months with no lights with you and your children. And I had her come in, I welcomed her in, and she sat down. She actually was looking around, and she said, but it's very neat, it's very clean, and the children are very clean. And I said, well, the children are at school. How did you see my children? She said, I actually went to school and I met with the principal and I talked to several of the teachers that had no clue that the children were living with no electricity because they were always neat and clean. And she asked me, how did I do that? And I told her, I said, I cooked in the morning. I bought water in the afternoons for everybody to take a bath. I did laundry as much as I could by hand. She couldn't understand how my house was so clean. While I had running water, I couldn't vacuum, so I'd sweep the carpet and everything was in order.
Now, the school had no idea that you were without power. Do you have any idea who made this call?
No, sir. At this time, I still have no clue as to who made that call. If I ever found out, I would like to thank that person because that person actually changed my life. When OCS arrived on my door, I was very hurt. I was devastated. I felt that I couldn't trust anybody. She gave me a week to get my power turned back on. And she said, when I come back in a week, if your utilities are not turned back on, I'm going to take your children. And I thought to myself, I can't lose my children. So I made a couple of phone calls. I called my mom, I called my dad, and I asked them for help. It seemed like every door that I tried to go through, a door was closing behind me. Nobody could help me. And so when she came back that following week, which happened to be October 31st of 1996, she said, Angela, did you get your lights turned back on? And I said, no, ma'am. She says, well, I can take the children and put them in state custody, or you can go to a shelter. And at that time, I started crying because my children meant everything to me, and I was not going to lose my children because I had no electricity. So she started to tell me about the shelter, and I continued to cry because all I could picture was the shelters I saw on TV. And I felt at that point that I had let my kids down, and I was very devastated by that.
Angela Angel says that's the moment when the reality of her situation really hit her. I'm Aaron Henkin, sitting in for Dick Gordon. This is The Story. Angela was headed for a shelter with her children, and while she was worried about their well-being, she was also preoccupied with something else.
At that point, I was pregnant, thinking I was having one baby, you know, and I'd been through a lot.
I can hear people wondering if you thought at any point you had too many children to support.
You know what? I never, ever thought that. I got overwhelmed at times because I was going through a lot. But my family turned their backs on me. And one thing I promised, no matter how many kids I had, I would never do that to them. I would always be there for them, no matter what we were going through. We were going to stick it out together, and that's just what we did. My oldest daughter at that time decided she wanted to go and stay with my ex-husband, so she didn't come with us to the shelter. I arrived there with six children. My son, who was two at the time, he wanted him to go and stay in Texas with his sister to kind of give me a hand until we got back on our feet. At that point, I was totally devastated. I cried nonstop because I was having to go to a shelter. I was having to leave two children behind. And that really hurt me. I thought at that point I was a total failure. I had let my kids down. I wasn't worthy of being a mother because of everything we had been through. And, you know, it's one thing to go through those things as a single person, but when you have children, and they caught up in the midst of no electricity, you know, not being able to play out past a certain time because you're afraid that it's going to get dark and they're not going to be able to see to take a bath. You know, that was a strain on the kids, but the kids never gave me any back talk. They didn't look down at me, but inside it was tearing me apart. It was really tearing me apart.
Angela Angel lived with her children in a trailer for 4 months without power. Once her living conditions were discovered by a social worker, she was given a choice. Go to a homeless shelter with her kids, or child services will take them away. Angela chose the homeless shelter. She packed whatever she could fit into a van driven by a nun named Sister Anne.
She hugged me, and she said everything's going to be okay. And I continued to cry, and tears were just rolling down my eyes, and she was hugging my children, helping us to unload things. And I kept saying to myself, why is she hugging me? Why does she care about me? I'm homeless. I'm going to a shelter. Why does she care about me? Earlier that day, I had brought some items from the milkman, and my thing was Cokes. I had 4 cases of Cokes with me. And Sister Ann told me at that time, she says, when you get to the shelter, you're going to have to share your Cokes. And one thing I told her is, I don't share my Cokes. I don't share anything. She says, but that's one thing you got to share at the shelter. I said, no, ma'am, I'm not sharing anything.
How did she react to you when you told her, no, thanks, I'm not going to be sharing my Cokes?
She didn't change toward me, not one time. That woman was so loving. She was like an angel to me, in spite of the fact that I was very cold to her. I didn't speak very much. But the only thing I said was, I'm not sharing my Cokes. And I kept thinking to myself, why is she so nice to me and my children? So when we got everything in the van and before I got in, she hugged me again and she says, Angela, it's going to be okay. It's going to be okay.
It must have been comforting to hear that everything is going to be okay, but did you believe her?
No, I didn't. I didn't believe it was going to be okay. I didn't believe that at all. And I kept thinking, how could she say that? She's not homeless. How could she say it's going to be okay? She don't know what I've been through.
You've talked about how this day made your head spin. I wonder how the kids handled it.
The kids, when they saw the other kids in the shelter and the party going on, they had a pinata, they had bobbing for apples. I mean, it was a big festivity going on in the shelter. And the kids started to interact with the other kids and just left me at the table crying.
I'm Aaron Henkin, in for Dick Gordon. In just a moment, Angela Angel tells us how she turned her tears into triumph at the homeless shelter. From American Public Media, this is The Story. I'm Aaron Henkin, sitting in for Dick Gordon. This is The Story. This year, the federal government granted almost $1 billion to support shelters and programs for the country's homeless. And it may not be enough, as the homeless population continues to grow. Angela Angel was part of that population. After supporting her 7 children in a trailer home with no electricity for months, she was confronted by Louisiana's Office of Children's Services. They gave her a choice: lose your kids, or go as a family to a homeless shelter. Angela wasn't about to give up her children, so she agreed to check into a shelter called the New Life Center. Angela says the daily schedule was intense, and it was hard to get used to.
Curfew, 5 o'clock. We had a lot of classes that we had to attend. Parenting classes, life skill classes, support classes. There was no child care center at that time, so the child that I had that was under the age of 4, she had to be with me all day long. And then they told me the kids, when they got back from school, there was an after-school tutoring program, but once that was over, all your children had to be with you at all times. I was having to go to the bathroom like every 20, 30 minutes because I was pregnant. So I would line the kids up along the wall and ask them to please stay there until I went to the bathroom. Then I'd come out and then we'd go either to our room or downstairs to play area, or I'd take them in the TV room.
And the kids, they were going to school during the day, and did they have other responsibilities or chores?
The children didn't have any chores, but I had chores. I had daily chores every day. Keeping up the bathroom, doing a kitchen prep chore, cleaning the dining area, cleaning front lobby, mopping.
So, Angela, let me just recap here. You've gone from living in a trailer with your children that had no power to being approached with the decision to either lose custody of your children or go together as a family to this homeless shelter. Your youngest child is now in an aunt's custody in Houston, Texas. You're pregnant. Is your life beginning to stabilize to some degree now that you're in the shelter?
No, not at all. Not at all. I was still confused, very confused. And a lot of things we were not able to bring to the shelter because I didn't have enough room to bring all my clothing, all my personal pictures and things that I really wanted to bring. So I brought what I could bring. I brought my Bible, a few pictures from my children. And don't forget, I brought my four cases of Cokes, which Sister Ann took me in the pantry, in the kitchen pantry, and she placed my Cokes on the shelf, and she said, "You're going to have to learn how to share." And again, I looked at her and I said, "I will not share my Cokes."
During Angela's first night at the homeless shelter, there came a moment when she got hit by a flood of emotions, guilt, regret, grief. She turned to her oldest son, Jake, and she made him a promise.
Jake was like my little right hand at the shelter. All the kids were going to sleep, and I looked to Jake, and I told him, "I know I've let y'all down, but I promise, when I get us out of here, I will never, ever let you all down again." And he said to me, "Mom, you didn't let us down," and tears were still rolling, and I said, "I did. I let y'all down because I lost the trailer. I lost being able to financially keep the lights on, and now we're living at a shelter." I said, "But I promise you, I will never, ever let you down again."
You got to the shelter around Halloween time. Thanksgiving rolls around. There's a problem with who's going to cook dinner.
Yes. The kitchen manager got sick. She was going to be out for a week. I went to Sister Ann's office, and I knocked on the door, and she says, "Angela, come in." And I said, "Well, Sister Ann," I said, "I know that Miss Mildred is out sick. I would like to take over and cook the meals for this week." And Sister Ann said, "Can you cook enough food to feed everybody in the shelter?" I looked at her in the face and I said, "Yes, ma'am, I can." I said, "If you give me a chance, I'll show you. I can do it."
How many people were at the shelter?
Oh, Lord, I'd say about 75 at that time. And then I had experience from working in restaurants that Sister Ann had no idea about. So that's how I was able to go in there and just handle that kitchen like it was my own.
Do you remember what you made for the people there?
I remember the first night I did spaghetti and meatball. I had green salad that was donated, fresh lettuce, and I did cucumbers and tomatoes in it with Italian salad dressing. I sprayed it over it. Because there wasn't enough Italian salad dressing for everybody to put some on their salad, so I stretched it. I added a little bit of vinegar and a little water and made it go. I made iced tea, and we had some bread, so I sliced bread and made garlic bread with it. And I tell you what, Sister Ann came to the kitchen. It was about 4:15. At that time, dinner was at 5, and she came, and I had the spaghetti was already cooked, meatballs. I had my salad ready. It was on the line. And I was just waiting on the garlic bread to come out because I wanted it to be just hot for when it was time to serve. Mm-hmm. I had put my tea on the line so that the ladies, when they come through the line, they could just pour their tea. She says, "How did you know how to cook all that?" I said, "Well, I used to work in a restaurant, and my mother-in-law taught me a lot about stretching. You could take a little bit and make a balanced meal out of it if you know how to stretch it." And that's just what I did. I stretched that spaghetti and meatball and that green salad. And the women kept saying, "Angela, are you cooking tomorrow night?" And I said, "Yeah, I'm actually cooking the rest of the week." I had no family or friends to go to be with. So New Life had started to become my family.
Now, here's the question. Did you ever end up sharing any of those Cokes?
I did. The residents at New Life were being so nice to me and my children. I actually pulled the Cokes out that Thanksgiving week, and I told Sister Ann that I wanted to share my drinks. She said, "But you don't share." I said, "I've learned to share. I'm learning.
She is gone.
I'm Aaron Henkin, in for Dick Gordon. This is The Story. During the 5 months that Angela lived at the New Life Center, she set two goals for herself.
One goal I had was to save money while there, to get on my own, which I did that when I moved out. The other goal was to come back and volunteer, which I did that. I volunteered. I'd walk, I think it's about 10 blocks from where I had moved from the shelter to where I moved into a two-bedroom house. That's all I could afford at the time. And one day I walked to the shelter and I asked Sister Ann, I would like to get a job. I would like for you to hire me. I would like to get off of welfare so that I can financially take care of my children the right way. She says, well, Angela, I can hire you part-time, but that's all I can do. I said, well, Sister Ann, I'll take part-time. I said, but really and truly, I need a full-time job because I'm tired of depending on welfare. So she hired me that week part-time. The following week, I would go in and I'd help the kitchen manager prep for the next day, help her prepare the dinner meal, serve that. Then I'd do a little residential managing until 10 o'clock. She seen I was helping the kitchen manager so good and I was just interacting with everybody that needed help. She called me in the office and hired me full time. And that was the happiest day of my life. I'll never forget that. That was May 31st, 1997. I'll never forget that. Sister Ann was moving to head her religious order in St. Louis, Missouri. Before she left, they had hired a director. And that director came on, and Sister Ann had 2 months to train her. I didn't know that Sister Ann had told the new director that if she needed any help, to ask Angela. And every morning when that lady started, after Sister Ann officially left, she was in my office needing help. I'd either type up things for her or email stuff for her. If she had a meeting, she didn't want to do the public speaking. I went and I spoke about New Life.
So it sounds like you were the functioning director, even though she had the title.
Correct. But I didn't want anybody in the main office to know that I was doing all our work because I was doing it from behind the scene. So she asked me to be her assistant to the director. I agreed. She put it on paper, but she didn't officially announce that I was her assistant. And the main office knew that, but still they didn't know that I was actually going to all her meetings, collecting all the rent, the fees from the women, you name it, I was doing it.
So Angela basically was running the show at the New Life Center, whether or not the program director appreciated her efforts. And things were coming together in the rest of Angela's life, too. She and her kids were out of the shelter and living in their own home, and she'd met and married the man of her dreams. His name was Martin. They spent 4 happy years together, but then Martin was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer. Angela took a month off from work to be with him during his final days. Sadly, Martin died on January 25th, 2006. Less than a week later, Angela got a telephone call. Her supervisor wanted her to come in for an emergency meeting.
She said, Angela, I've noticed that in the time you've been out taking care of your husband, everything started falling apart at New Life. It's come to my attention that you were doing all the work. I know you took off a month, but I need you to come back. I need you to help me put everything back in place and put everything back in order. She said, and I know I can't do it without you. I said, just give me this week to just take care of some last minute stuff. I said, but I will be back on Monday. She said, Angela, I can wait till Monday. When you come back, you will not come back as a case manager, the so-called assistant to the director. You will come back as the program director. She said, that's your new position. And I'm giving you a raise as of today. I said, thank you, Miss Kim.
Could you believe what you were hearing? Was this a surprise to you?
It was a surprise, all out the blue. All out the blue. I didn't expect that. I didn't expect that at all.
So in February of 2006, you became program director at New Life Center. And shortly after, you became director.
Yes.
When you look back at all these different chapters of your life, you've faced a lot more adversity than most people face in a lifetime, and I wonder what it is that's kept you going through all of it.
God has been good to me, that's all I could say. The best thing that has happened to me is my new life. I met a lady through New Life. She came one day to speak at a support group, and she motivated me. She looked at me like Sister Ann looked at me, like I was so important, so special. And That's how I look at the women today. All the women that come to New Life are important to me. They're special to me. I love to be there when we have a new client entering the doors of New Life so that I can say, good morning or good afternoon. My name is Angela Angel, the director, and I would like to say welcome to New Life, and everything will be okay. And I've had some women look at me and say, you don't know what it's like to be here. And then I can turn around and say, well, why don't you come into my office and let me tell you what my life has been like before I became the director.
You can find out more about Angela Angel and the New Life Center at our website, thestory.org. Last week, the story featured the grandmother of all reality TV shows, the 1950s program Queen for a Day. Dick Gordon talked to two women whose mother was on that program.
Would you like to be queen for a day?
To have this unexpected thing happen in her life where she was the star.
She never thought any dream was too far to reach for. You can't strive for it, and you can dream.
We always felt the pinch growing up. My dad always had two jobs, worked very hard, and he had been a milkman, as a grocery clerk, and I knew that we were what I would call poor. I knew that. In fact, as I was going through her letters, I came across a point where she was trying to explain their dire financial situation that they were in, and she said, I'm going to win Queen for a Day and get us out of this mess.
My husband could quit his job and make baby swings instead of the heavy work that he is now doing.
Good for you. Well, you got that figured out. And here you've invented something, and you have a market, and all you need now are 300 springs and an electric drill.
Karen from Milwaukee wrote us to say, the story about Queen for a Day was so earth-shaking for me. It really took me down memory lane. My mother had mental illness and other issues. As a child, I felt like most of the things she told us were figments of her imagination. And they were. My mother told us she had won Queen for a Day, and honestly, we thought it was all an illusion in her mind. We really didn't believe her. But later, I found a newspaper clipping of her with the show's host, Jack Bailey, and it was clear she had won this honor. Thank you for touching on this story for me. I believe Queen for a Day was the absolute highlight of my mother's life. Annette from San Pedro, California, also heard that program. She wrote to say, the story reminded me that my grandmother was also queen for a day. My mom told us that her mother won, and she received the same gifts. Those gifts gave a grandmother a lot of help. Now, she's the mother of 14 and had 7 boys and 7 girls. She is still alive today at the age of 92. I'm just grateful that I was able to hear their mother's story. For Kathy in Studio City, California, the Queen for a Day program also had a personal connection. That was such an amazing, wonderful story. Thanks for the fun and nostalgia. My mom would love it, so I will send the URL to her in Denver. I know she was in one of the Queen for a Day audiences in the past. Coming up when I return, how a brush with fame can become a lifelong touchstone. That's exactly what happened to one photographer who, through sheer luck, ended up traveling with Muhammad Ali to the Rumble in the Jungle in what was then Zaire in 1974. Here's some archival audio of the greatest saying, well, he's the greatest.
I have a poem that says, this is the legend of Muhammad Ali, the most popular fighter there ever will be. He talks a great deal and brags indeed of a powerful punch and blinding speed. The fistic world is dull and weary. With a champ like Foreman, things got to be dreary. Now, someone with color, someone with dash, he brings fight fans a-running with cash. This brash boxer is something to see. The heavyweight championship is his destiny. Ali fights great. He's got speed and endurance. If you sign to fight him, increase your insurance.
Another brush with fame when we return. I'm Aaron Henkin, sitting in for Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Aaron Henkin, sitting in for Dick Gordon. Photographing celebrities is big business. People magazine reportedly paid $4 to $6 million for pictures of Jennifer Lopez's twins, reports the magazine denies. But a compromising photo of Britney Spears can go for hundreds of thousands, as every paparazzi knows. But sometimes, photographing a celebrity can change a person's life. That's what happened to Sonia Kachin. She never set out to be a celebrity photographer, but her finest hour actually came when she crossed paths with the greatest celebrity of them all.
Bear, I'd have wrestled with an alligator. That's right, I have wrestled with an alligator. I done tussled with a whale. I done handcuffed lightning, throw thunder in jail. That's bad. Only last week, I murdered a rock, injured a stone, hospitalize a brick. I'm so mean, I make medicine sick.
Bad dude. Incredible.
And you, George Foreman, all of you chumps are gonna bow when I whoop him. The man's in trouble. I'm gonna show you how great I am.
Muhammad Ali was, of course, talking about his rumble in the jungle with George Foreman. It was 1974, and as Sonia told Dick Gordon earlier that year, she happened to be visiting her sister in New York.
My dear sister Anahid and I were walking down the aisles of Saks Fifth Avenue, and by then I was into shooting celebrities, but I could never recognize famous people. Never.
Someone would always have to say?
Yes, yes. Anahid, which sometimes she would rip me, there goes so-and-so. I go, how do you know? How do you see that? And she always did, and I never did. I don't know why. And so she goes, there's Muhammad Ali. I said, uh-huh. She goes, I said, so? She goes, no, there's Ali. I said, yeah, okay, I see him. She goes, Sonia, go get him. And I literally felt her push the back of my lower ribs and pushed me towards him.
Did you have your camera gear with you at the time?
I always had it.
Okay.
So I followed him out the door. He had already walked out of Saks by then. He was very fast. And I looked up Fifth Avenue, down Fifth Avenue, no Muhammad Ali. And I thought, okay, so he's not here. And then I saw a taxi standing right in front of me. And I thought, I wonder if he got into the taxi. So I approached and I stuck my head in the window. I go, Mr. Ali? And I'm like, I don't even know why I'm asking him. Just she told me to. And this deep, gravelly voice goes, yeah. I thought, what is this voice? And by then, his face was coming into focus because it was dark in there. And then he got closer to the window. He goes, he reaches out. He thought I was wanting an autograph. And I said, I'm a photographer and I'd like to photograph you sometime. May I? And he said, sure. And the taxi driver was just getting the car started. He told the cab driver to stop. And I thought, what a remarkable person. He's telling him to stop for me? Doesn't even know me. And he said, let me write you the phone number and address. And he was with two friends. He said, give me a piece of paper. And he very slowly and carefully wrote his phone number at Deer Lake.
His training camp at Deer Lake,
famous,
Pennsylvania.
Yeah. Mm-hmm, training camp there. And I called. And he said, come on up. And I started going up there. And that's how it started.
I want to fast forward, if I can, to the rumble in the jungle. This is an experience that must be so deeply etched in your memory. This is, you're in a country that doesn't even exist anymore. You're on your way to Zaire, now known as Congo, to cover what some people even today say was one of the greatest boxing matches ever in history. How did you even get included on the manifest of the plane that was going from New York to Africa?
All I can say is I was known for these things.
Good things happen to you, or you made good things happen?
You know, Dick, when the will is strong, the body follows. I don't know what else to say. It didn't seem impossible to me. I wanted to go on this trip. I'd never been at a boxing. I hadn't even been at an ordinary boxing match, let alone the heavyweight championship of the world. So I didn't know what to expect.
Sonia Katchen got on that flight. I'm Aaron Henkin, in for Dick Gordon. And Sonia told Dick that during her time in what was then called Zaire, she actually became quite close to Muhammad Ali and his entourage.
We stopped in Paris. He had a press conference in Paris, and he thought I was getting off at that point. And he turned to me, he goes, "You going all the way?" And I just nodded, you know, mischievously, "Yes, yes, I'm going all the way." And you can't imagine the excitement when we got off the plane. The drummers, the dancers.
Oh, you're in Kinshasa now. Okay.
Yes, when we landed in Kinshasa, it's the middle of the night. Oh, what a jubilation. And Don King and everybody, "My homeland, my homeland." And the press corps who was with us then went on to their hotels in Kinshasa, and Ali and his entourage proceeded to the location that the president had for him, some villas. So I continued.
So you went to your hotel?
Well, I hadn't planned very well.
You didn't have a hotel.
I didn't have a booking. So I just stuck with the camp. And there was some jibing during those weeks from the press corps saying, "Are you from the press corps or are you part of Ali's entourage?" And I said, "Can't I be both?" So there you are.
They found a place for you with the entourage?
So here's the picture. We're all in the living room of Ali's villa, and he's allocating people to the different villas. And he looks at me, he goes, "You don't have a place, do you?" Just shook my head. I mean, what generosity of spirit.
Why? What did he do?
It was no skin off his nose to include me in his list of people who were with him.
And no skin off his nose to say, go into town and find yourself a hotel room either. I mean, he could just as easily have done that.
A lesser person would have. It's not just warmth. It's a charisma that goes from one side of the room to the other. And when he's in a room, everything else stops.
You took one shot. Ali is running along a road. It looks like a two-lane road, kind of separate, because there's a bus or an open sort of bus of people going in the other direction. Do you know the picture I'm talking about?
I do. I call it road work from my Zaire series. This was at 5:30 a.m. Every morning he would run for 45 minutes. And I'm not an early morning person. So I had to get up at 4:30 to be there by 5:30. And I'm in the back of the station wagon when he started running. I tried to get out of the back of the station wagon, but I ended up flat on my behind, rolling with my cameras, trying to cover up my cameras so they wouldn't get injured. And he looked at me and he said, "That was dumb." And very soon thereafter, this truck full of day workers came by.
Now, this truck goes by. Do they know who they're seeing? Do they know that's Ali?
They were just jumping up and down in the truck, and you can see them waving their hands.
And what's his reaction? You know, here he is on the other side of the world, and people are showering on him the same kind of adulation that he would get from his fans in the U.S. What's his reaction to them? Is he just ignoring them? Is he kind of playing to them?
He loves people, and he will stop everything.
But what would he have done on that day? Would he have waved to them, given them a big smile?
Of course he waved to them.
See, and you shot this guy with his mother and his father and his trainer and his camp, and I knew him only through the way the media portrayed him at his high points. And I've never been able to figure out if he's the real deal or not, or if he has this wonderful ability to kind of turn it on when the camera's on and then power down when the cameras aren't there. What's the real story?
Ali not only was what he seemed to be to the media, but he was more. This is a man who is so modest, so humble, and gentle and quiet. Now, that doesn't sound like the Muhammad Ali we know.
I'm about to ask you to connect the dot between the guy who says, I'm the greatest, and the guy who is so humble.
He has a humility with people, and he has a respect for God that is so palpable.
Talk to me, though, about the way that he interacted with you. You could have been just another photographer, but you had some kind of a relationship with him. He was aware that you were there when he's kissing his mother. He's aware that you're there. Would he look out the corner of his eye and say, yeah, Sonia's there? I got to be on my toes. She might take a picture.
No, but in this particular image that you were mentioning, there is definitely that awareness that I was there because there were no other photographers there that day. And when the truck went by, I remember thinking that he's waving to them and they're waving to him, and what a great picture this is. And I know that when I look at the picture real close, he's looking at me to make sure I'm getting the picture. So he, in a sense, he made some of these pictures. I cannot claim a lot of the pictures. Even the last picture in the set, in the Ali Folio set, is a picture of him sitting in a darkened room in Chicago. It's his living room. And I had walked in noticing he was there alone. He was humming a little tune to himself. I had never heard him sing. And I asked before taking the picture, even though he knew, I mean, I was there with him, but you know, there I am with my Leica. I said, Champ, can I take a picture? He nodded his head yes. I took the picture, and then he quietly lifted his fist, and I got this silhouette.
You took one more picture.
One
him
more
in
picture.
Silhouette with his fist.
And I can't take credit for it. We made it together.
You're listening to The Story. I'm Aaron Henkin, sitting in for Dick Gordon. Dick is talking with Sonia Katchen about her time with the legendary boxer Muhammad Ali. Sonia says she remembers the Ali-Foreman fight in Kinshasa like it was yesterday. She told Dick about the moments leading up to the Rumble in the Jungle in October 1974.
First of all, it was at 4 a.m. so that it would coincide with prime time in the East Coast of the United States. I was given a credential to shoot from ringside, and I have to say, to toot my little horn, I was the first woman photographer to be credentialed at ringside. I didn't realize that at the time, but when I look back, I see that's what it was. And I had my little spot, and all these big-time photographers had their spots. And Ali's personal photographer was in his corner, shooting from his corner, and I was shooting just down the apron of the ring. And the sweat started coming when the fight started. I couldn't believe, you know, getting sweat on their sweat, not my sweat, on the camera, on my body. It was something.
You got some great shots.
I did.
Did you get the I'm standing over my defeated opponent shot?
Oh, the referee was standing right in front of me. But I did get the best rope-a-dope picture. What's great about that picture is that you can see Ali's eye looking at Foreman, studying Foreman as Ali leans against the ropes to protect himself from the blows. He's observing. He's a master observer. Master. And
were you self-conscious
Foreman,
around him? I mean, if he's that much of an observer, were you conscious of him watching you when you were around him with cameras?
Very, but you cannot catch him watching you. That's how fast he is. What was the joke he made?
Fast. Last night I cut the light off my bedroom, hit the switch, was in the bed before the room was dark.
Incredible.
Fast.
That was one of his jokes.
you started out seeing Ali when you weren't even interested in who the man was.
Yeah.
You went to his training camp. You had nearly 2 months with him in Zaire in the preparation for that Rumble in the Jungle fight. You've seen him and photographed him in subsequent years. What's the one image of him which comes first to your mind, the most powerful, most expressive image of Muhammad Ali?
Dick, you ask good questions. That's what Ali would have said.
I'll take that as a backhanded compliment.
I'm a bad imitator. But that is a good question because it's a shot I didn't take. What remains in my mind was the time when James Brown and Bill Withers and all the musicians came for the pre-fight show, and Ali was in the audience. He was like in the fourth row or something. And I remember at one point, I'm up near the stage, so I can look towards the audience. I remember looking, and I could have sworn that I saw his aura around him. I don't know how else to explain this, but it's like this warmth that radiates from his body. Some people have said that that wasn't his prime, that his prime was in the prior years, but other observers have said that this was when he was at his prime as a human being, as a person. This was when he was at his richest. He had all of his capacities and sharp as a tack.
And you were aware of it whenever you were close to him. You would be aware of it in a hotel room if you just walked in and there were other people there.
Other people say it too.
You'd see it in the only one. You'd feel it in the locker room after the fight.
Yeah.
Did you have a crush on this guy? He's so extraordinarily good looking. And when I hear your description of him, I can't think how you could be around him and be a woman and not be powerfully attracted to him.
I built quite a strong boundary. It had to be there, Dick. If it wasn't there, then I wouldn't be able to take the next step and the next gig and the next event.
Right. You'd end up spinning in a little circle like a schoolgirl, just besotted with the man.
Yeah. What's the point?
Falling in love with Ali? Could be worse.
Well, we were all in love with Ali. There's no one who could say they weren't. So I'd be lying if I said I wasn't.
Well, Sonia, it's been fun having you in. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you so much for having me, Dick.
Sonia Katchen is still behind the lens. You can find images from her portfolio at our website, thestory.org. Have you ever had a memorable brush with fame? A moment of your own when you were in the presence of celebrity greatness? Well, we'd love to hear from you. Our email address again, thestory.org. You can also write us the old-fashioned way, The Story, 120 Friday Center Drive, Chapel Hill, North Carolina, and the zip code 27517. That's 27517. That's the show for today. I'm Aaron Henkin, in for Dick Gordon. From American Public Media, this is The Story. Rambo emperor na gangi zilanzula e. Oh yeah, piloto ngeringeriyo. Panakini mi balingelingeliye. Ichasa kese, piloto ngeringeriyo. Saiko music ngeringeliye. Langa, piloto ngeringeriyo.
The Story is a production of North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.
American Public Media.